From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Happy birthday, America. Welcome to our Independence Night program. Later on tonight, the search for Sasquatch. Here's what's happening. There are no immediate reports of injuries or significant damage after a 6.4 magnitude earthquake rattled parts of Southern California and Nevada. I didn't feel it at all. Michael Crozier from KFI News is with us now. Michael, did you feel anything?
I did. I felt it this morning. I was in bed because, you know, I work with you on the overnights. So about 10 o'clock my time. I live in Claremont. It's about 40 miles east of L.A., so about 120 miles south from where this thing ended up being centered. And it woke me up about 10 o'clock. It was a nice little roll for me. And it's one of those ones where you kind of, you're half asleep, you wake up and you go, is this a truck going by outside?
Man, I didn't feel anything.
You didn't.
That's what I get being from the Midwest. I'm not used to this stuff, I guess.
I know, right? And, this is the strongest one we felt in 20 years. So it was a little bit of an assessment, I think, by most people trying to figure out if that's what it really was, because we haven't felt such a big one in such a while. And we've gotten reports from people all the way down to Long Beach, Santa Barbara, way out there.
Out to Las Vegas.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Right. It's one of those, I think, higher surface ones that it just allowed us to carry a little bit further.
Now, here's the big question. Everybody's talking about, is there another big one coming right behind this one?
And that's what they have been saying. You know, some of the experts saying, you know, we could get another five, another high, a little bit higher one. And the big question, obviously, always is this a precursor? But we had pre-shocks before this one hit, and then we had some shocks afterwards. I think they said one of the highest ones was just a little bit under five. But they said, you know, always keep an eye out. The more time that goes by, the lower chance that there is that there'll be another big one.
All right, Michael, thanks for the report.
You got it, sir.
Michael Crozier from our KFI affiliate here in Los Angeles. A couple weeks ago, Cal Ory, one of our news guests, of course, predicted an earthquake for Los Angeles. North Korea accusing the Trump administration of talking out of both sides of its mouth, saying the U.S. is publicly pushing the narrative of open dialogue between the two nations, but is more hell-bent on hostile acts. I don't know what's going on over there. British Royal Marines seized a giant Iranian oil tanker in Gibraltar for trying to take oil to Syria in violation of the EU sanctions. Now, that's a dramatic step that drew anger from Iran, and it could escalate its front confrontation with the West. Amazon will store Alexa voice logs forever unless you somehow delete it. That's right. If you're not creeped out yet by the little robot Alexa eavesdropping in your house, it might be time to reconsider. Confirming the suspicions of some privacy advocates and a member of Congress, Amazon has admitted in a letter to Congress that voice recordings stored by Alexa in home assistant devices do in fact remain on the company servers. Let's check in with our expert on the internet, Lauren Weinstein. Lauren, how long is this going to happen?
Well, first, let me wish you a happy 4th of July.
You too, sir.
You and everyone. You may hear fireworks in the background here. There's a lot of activity here in the neighborhood. The thing about the entire concern about privacy with smart speakers, of which Alexa is one example, is what kinds of information is being saved, not just how long it's being saved, what is being saved. And we have to remember, as we've discussed in the past, that except in exceptional situations where something goes wrong or there's a misfire, basically, the only information that goes up to those servers is what's said after the hot phrase, the hot word is spoken. So, you know, after you say Alexa or after you say, hey, Google, that sort of thing. And by and large, those are fairly innocuous kinds of statements.
Right.
They're going to be things like Alexa, turn on the lights. Alexa, play Yellow Submarine. What's the temperature? Order a box of Cracker Jack. That kind of thing. Now, if you compare that with the sorts of information that you tend to put into search engines, for example, you tend to make much more personal. You know, the kinds of queries you make tend to be very personal in search engines. And so then it becomes more important that there's ways to control that data. So, for example, Google has a whole mechanism for users to delete their search engine information and things like that. It's very elaborate and very complete. What Amazon's doing here with Alexa is certainly sloppy, and it's not user friendly. Part of the information that they have there, they know that they have to keep, because, for example, if people are ordering things through Alexa, and there are people that order through smart speakers.
It's absolutely.
It's not taking off the way they
expected it.
Hoped. Yeah. But some people do it. And those kinds of recordings, of course, have to be kept because they're sales transaction type information. And Amazon does have a way that you can go in there and delete it. They can certainly be taken to task for the fact that they don't make it easy to do, and they don't promote the fact that it's there. And that's a very important lesson. That's sort of at the heart of this whole thing. If you have controls for users that affect their privacy, they're useless if you don't tell people about them.
That's right. Now, will Alexa record if you don't call its name first?
It should not. Now
that's
not
what they say.
The way these work is they listen locally. The processor on the smart speaker is listening locally for the key phrase, for the target phrase, and only when it hears it does it start sending information up. Now, that's not 100%, because occasionally there will be false hits. There'll be false positives, and it'll think you said the key word, the key phrase, when you didn't, and then it'll take some time before it realizes there's no command there. And it just stops listening. Now, all of these devices, as far as I know, that I've ever seen anyway, do have lights on them to indicate when the mic has been opened up that
right,
way.
Right. Now, any word to the wise here?
Well, the main thing is, you know, find out what privacy controls are there. I mean, if you go to the help pages for these systems, you can usually find it. It's just that they don't promote the fact that it's there. Find those settings and use the facilities that are available to delete information that you don't want to be present anymore. Usually you can do it. In cases where you can't, if there's sensitive information that you can't delete, that's a real problem, and that's really where I think there's some focus in terms of people looking at regulations. But by and large, the companies have ways to do it. Just some of the companies are better at telling people about it than others.
Okay, my friend. Thanks, Lauren. And again, you have a great Independence Weekend. A boy became infected with flesh-eating bacteria during a trip to a Maryland beach last week. The boy developed the infection after swimming near Ocean City. The following day, his mother noted some spots and sores all over his body. Now they're all over his legs. That stuff's horrible. Alfred E. Newman. Those of you who remember the face of Mad Magazine since 1956 will no longer be around. After nearly seven decades of the gap-tooth shenanigans, Mad Magazine will reportedly no longer be available on newsstands after issue number 9 in August. Neither heavy rain nor a raft of criticism prevented President Donald Trump from delivering his salute to America to a crowd on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. In his remarks, the president told Americans, "We are part of one of the greatest stories ever told." Well, he's right about that. It is one of the greatest countries ever, and we have freedom. And I thought we'd bring in Howard Bloom to tell us why. Howard, happy Independence Day.
Happy Independence Day. I agree with you totally. This is one of the greatest countries on the face of the earth, and it's because of our commitment to freedom. So, freedom, but there's a problem. Freedom seems like an indelible part of the American experience, and it feels like something tattooed into you and me at birth. It seems like something we could never lose. But freedom is more fragile than you and I think. 68 countries lost freedoms in 2018. The protesters of Hong Kong, Sudan, and Algeria are fighting for their freedoms, and the odds are that they won't get them. Meanwhile, leaders like Russia's Vladimir Putin, North Korea's Kim Jong-un, China's Xi Jinping, Saudi Arabia's Mohammed bin Salman, Turkey's Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and Iran's Ali Husseini Khamenei have seized entire nations by the throat and eradicated their freedoms. And similar cults of personality and one-man tyrannies could easily happen here, which means we have to protect and defend our freedom for all we're worth. Look, in 1776, we caught a lucky break. The founding fathers were busy running a government of war, so they shoved the irritating assignment of writing a Declaration of Independence off on 433-year-old Thomas Jefferson. Now, 1776 was a very strange year in which to write a Declaration of Independence. England's Edward Gibbon had just finished 25 years studying the history of the Roman of ancient Rome and published a three-volume book called The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. And in Gibbon's book, he analyzed Rome's freedoms, and he showed how Rome lost them. And in 1776, Scottish moral philosopher Adam Smith invented modern economics and published his most important book, The Wealth of Nations. Now, Smith's book made the first powerful case for the advantages of free markets. What's more, in 1776, a muddy catchphrase from the British philosopher John Locke was in the air. It went like this: being all equal and independent, no one ought to harm another in his life, health, liberty, or possessions. In other words, 1776 was the height of a new cultural fever called the Enlightenment, and Thomas Jefferson caught the Enlightenment's lightning in a bottle with the opening lines of his Declaration of Independence, quote, "We declare these truths to be self-evident, all men are created equal, with the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Then 24,000 Americans died in a revolutionary war with Britain. They died to bring to life a government based on something else that the British philosopher John Locke had written about, a government that does not draw its legitimacy from the divine right of a king, a government that draws its legitimacy from the consent of the governed, from we the people, a democracy, a republic without a king, without a dictator, and without a supreme leader. A government with a Bill of Rights that guarantees freedom of religion, freedom of speech, and freedom of assembly. Now, most important, it's a government that values those who protest against its injustices. So on this 4th of July, it's crucial to remember that eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. Our freedom will exist only as long as we defend it, which means Republicans have to defend the freedom of Democrats. Democrats have to defend the freedom of Republicans. Conservatives have to struggle for the freedom of progressives, and progressives have to fight for the freedom of conservatives. Conservatism, libertarianism, socialism, capitalism, progressivism, they are choices. And without choices, your freedom and mine does not exist. So the bottom line comes from another major influence on the spirit of the West in 1776. The French philosopher Voltaire, you know this quote, "I disagree with what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it."
And that is our creed on this program as well. Howard Bloom, well said. Thank you so much. Up next, we're going to talk about the criminal justice system, the government, and how it affects all of us with Judge Jim Gray next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to our Independence Night program. George Norrie with you. Our special guest for the next couple hours, James P. Gray, the judge, has been a trial judge in Orange County, California, since 1983. Before becoming a judge, he served as a volunteer in the Peace Corps in Costa Rica, a staff judge advocate and criminal defense attorney in the Navy JAG Corps, a federal prosecutor in Los Angeles, and a civil litigating attorney in a private law firm. In addition, he was a Republican candidate for Congress in 1998 and a Libertarian candidate for U.S. Senate in 2004. Judge, welcome back to the program. How are you, sir?
George, I'm just great. Thank you. And it's always nice to share thoughts with good people.
And thank you for spending your Independence Night with us. I really appreciate it.
This was inspirational just listening to your program so far, George. You know, I truly believe that the soul of the United States of America is our freedoms and our liberties. I also think our soul is under attack by our very own government, and your various speakers prior to this were just talking about the importance of liberty and our country and our independence. So good for you.
I spent 9 years in the Navy. I'm glad I never had to use your services in the JAG Corps.
Well, that's true. You probably wouldn't have wanted to face me then, but I'm out now, George, and thanks for your service.
What have you been up to these days?
Well, you know, life is interesting. I am now a private judge, so I do private arbitrations and mediations and work with the courts, but I introduced myself to the various litigants saying, yes, I was a trial court judge here in Orange County, California for 25 years, but I retired 10 years ago. But I became a judge when I was 12 years old. That's why I'm still so young, and I don't allow any cross-examination on that issue whatsoever.
Perfect.
So it kind of gets us off on the right foot.
How is our justice system functioning today, in your opinion?
George, I actually think that we're doing a pretty good job. Yes, it could be faster and less expensive, but I think that that maybe you heard it here first, but life is complicated. We have different problems and the rest, but I think our system works pretty well, and I'm proud of it, and I'm proud to be a part of it.
Now, you know, there are some cases, of course, we're dealing with a lot of different issues here, civil litigation, criminal litigation, and things like that. Is that being abused at all, Judge, by anybody?
Well, like I said, George, life is complicated, and if you get into any system, people can take advantage of it and play the system. We have the Americans with Disabilities Act, which everyone wanted to serve people who are in wheelchairs to carve off the curb so they could, you know, live more normal lives. But yes, anytime you have a system, people are going to take advantage of it, and they kind of get into some legal extortion that kind of makes things not work. But let me start it this way. The justice system is the only system of our three branches of government that is there to protect minority rights. You get to the executive and they win by winning the majority and they focus on the majority. Same thing with the legislature. So in many ways, George, I think that the judicial system is the most important branch of government because it stands up and protects minority rights. And I've just finished, actually, with two partners, a musical called Convention, The Birth of America, and it's about the Constitutional Convention, so I'm pretty aware of what the founders were saying. And by the way, every last one, there were 55, and they fought about lots of things and disputed and argued, but the thing that each one of those delegates felt was the most important function of government is protecting our liberties from the encroachment of government. Number two is security, by the way. So I think our founders would be extremely upset with us today in allowing our liberties to be eroded by our government in the name of the war on drugs, in the name of war on terror, whatever else. But it's the judicial system that safeguards our civil liberties from the encroachment of government, and I'm proud of that.
Since you brought up the war on drugs, there are 11 states so far that have approved using cannabis. And in some cases, Illinois, for example, the most recent state, they're deciding what to do with 800,000 people that had been incarcerated or convicted or have it on their record of these petty drug crimes, which I think they want to eradicate that off of people's records. I think that might be the right thing to do. What do you think?
I do, too. You know, honestly, and I did something extremely unusual for a sitting trial court judge back in 1992 in Orange County, California, held a press conference. And judges do not do that. But I told anyone that would listen that our nation's war on drugs, drug prohibition, was not working. We have unduly tried to get away from these problems. And the substances can cause problems, but we're trying to eradicate it by putting people in prison, and you just cannot incarcerate your way out of this. So we have overdone the incarceration and jailing of numbers of people for fairly minor offenses, and like you say, I think that is on the way to be eradicated. But if somebody sells some illegal drugs just because they're illegal to make money, I think they should be accountable for that, and they should certainly serve some time in prison. But we have really overdone it, and it's been a fraud on the taxpayer. It's been a fraud on other people, and we've taken a lot of parents away from their children, which has then basically had the children follow the footsteps of their parents. So we've really overdone this incarceration stuff.
Plus, a lot of junk like fentanyl is getting into the system now. That could kill people instantly.
George, that is a serious problem, and it's caused by drug prohibition. You know, we don't have any quality control, any testing of illegal drugs, and so it's basically China and North Korea that are putting this fentanyl into our system, and it's death. You've all gone to restaurants, you've seen these little packets of sugar. I understand that if you take that much fentanyl just in the same amount as a packet of sugar, it can kill like 100 people. It's deeply serious stuff caused by drug prohibition and the lack of control.
Absolutely. And what these drug dealers do, Judge, as you well know, is they put it into cocaine and other drugs, heroin, to try to cut it, to increase the use of it, and they're killing people.
And you're absolutely right. And you go back, you know, I was on the bench for 25 years, like I say, and I still remember there was about two occasions in which I was sentencing two young men on different times for being under the influence of methamphetamines. And in our courts in California, and pretty much any courts around the country, before you plead guilty, you have to give us what you call a factual basis. You have to put in your own words why you're guilty of the offense. And each of these two young men said, Your Honor, I had my drug of choice was marijuana, and I'd buy my marijuana from the same supplier for years. Unbeknownst to me, one day they sold me some marijuana laced with methamphetamine.
Oh.
I smoked it a few times and I got hooked.
He got hooked.
I still remember thinking, look, you know, if we all know smoking cigarettes is hazardous to your health, but at least if you go to your local mini mart and buy a pack of Marlboros, you're going to know it's not laced with methamphetamine.
Exactly. Judge, stay with us. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with more phone calls with the judge next hour on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. We're with Judge Jim Gray. We'll take calls with the judge next hour. Judge, I know as a lawyer, you know, you're required, your creed is to defend the guilty, the innocent, to represent them. Is that difficult for lawyers if you're in a case and you know this guy is guilty, his sin, and that he probably committed this horrendous crime, and you still have to defend them as a lawyer? Is that tough?
No, you know, the defense attorneys in criminal cases fulfill an enormously important function, kind of there but the grace of God go I. They simply are required to make the prosecutor do its job. Make the system work is the way I describe it. So if the defense attorney requires the prosecutor to submit enough evidence, lawful evidence in court, to show the guilt beyond a doubt based upon reason to 12 neutral jurors of the guilt of the client, then, you know, the guilty finding comes in, but the defense attorney did his or her job. And it's an enormously important function. We all, as citizens, in my view, we have numbers of benefits, of course, for being a citizen of this country. We also have obligations, and one of them is to make the system work within our lives. And I say that, you know, it's our government, George, and if it isn't working, it's no one's fault but our own. And it's the same thing with regard to any system. And the criminal defense attorneys perform an enormously important job, even though they happen to know that their client probably is good for that offense. It's a lot better to have 9 people who are guilty go free than 1 innocent person be punished. So
that's
true. It's part of the system, and I'm proud of it. And basically, it works.
Well, and there's no question our system is based on the person is innocent until proven guilty, and that's just the way it's got to be. Even if you witness somebody shooting somebody, technically he's innocent until he's convicted.
And precisely right, and it's a part of our system also, George, that we do not punish somebody before they're convicted, and that also means that no one should be arrested before they're convicted unless they're either a flight risk, they're not going to show up for trial, or they are a security threat to witnesses or the public. And we overdo the pretrial arrest of numbers of people, and that's wrong as well. That's an abuse of power. So it's up to us to blow the whistle on this sort of thing and to safeguard our liberties for everyone.
Back to drugs for a second, Judge. What would happen if we legalized everything and created some kind of tiered system of, you know, for getting into the hands of people, setting up clinics and things like that, but we stopped convicting people using it, putting them in jail, and just made it legal for them?
Let's start with Robert Downey Jr. is a very successful artist and actor,
good actor,
making good movies. He's had pretty much a lifelong heroin problem, and I understand that. But it makes as much sense to me to put Robert Downey Jr. in jail for his heroin problem as it would have Betty Ford in jail for her alcohol
mm-hmm.
problem. It's the same thing. It's a medical issue, but if Robert Downey Jr., Betty Ford, you or I drive a motor vehicle impaired by, you name it, methamphetamines, alcohol, marijuana, whatever, that's a crime. And the difference is now they are putting our safety at risk. But otherwise, it makes as much sense to me as a libertarian to put Robert Downey Jr. in jail for what he puts into his body as it does what he puts into his mind. It's none of the government's business. And the criminal justice system is really designed for and quite good at protecting us from each other. It's not designed for and really poor at trying to protect us from ourselves. So that's what the war on drugs has tried to do, hold people accountable as adults for their actions, not what they put into their bodies. So I think you're absolutely right, and I wish more people would understand that.
Yeah, me too. And we should do with drugs exactly what we do with alcohol. You know, if it's a certain alcohol limit and somebody's involved in a moving violation, or God forbid, they hit somebody, you know, they're going to pay the price. And that should be the same thing with drugs.
And, you know, when we finally came to our senses and repealed alcohol prohibitions, homicides went down by 40% the next year in our country, countrywide. And I'm convinced the same thing will happen when we finally repeal drug prohibition. It's the same thing.
Well, you also get to start taxing the drug money, because those suppliers are going to do it legally because it's no longer illegal.
You know, hey, let's take away a lot of money from Mexican drug cartels and juvenile street gangs and other thugs and use it to pay our firefighters and pay our teachers and fix our roads. I mean, how hard can this be? People are going to use it anyway. I'm from California. George, for the last decade or more, marijuana has been the largest cash crop in the state of California. Number two is grapes, by the way, but that tells me somebody's using it. So if they are, let's regulate it, control it, tax it, and bring it back under the law. And don't take my word for it. Ask our listeners to ask the next 10 teenagers they find, hey, if you wanted to, what is easier for you to get, marijuana or alcohol? And every last one of those teenagers, if they cared, would say it's easier to get marijuana. Why? Because the illegal dealers don't ask for ID. It's really straightforward.
Absolutely. And I think eventually it's going to come to legalization of all this. What do you think?
Well, I don't mean to get too technical, but if you're going to talk legal drugs, think aspirin. You know, anybody, your 12-year-old daughter could go to your local pharmacy and buy a case of aspirin. There's no age restrictions.
No, they can do that now.
There's no advertising, but we need to regulate it and control it like alcohol, and that's what we should do. And as to the other drugs, you know, the heroines and methamphetamines, bring it under the control of medical doctors. It's a medical issue, and then hold doctors responsible for acting within their profession. But otherwise, leaving Al Capone and Mexican drug cartels in charge of this flat out doesn't work, except for the prison guards union. They're thriving.
Well, and one could say the CIA is involved in that, too, for black ops money. You never know.
You know, you said I was in the U.S. Attorney's Office, and I was. There was a guy named Rob Bonner, who was my chief of criminal at the time. He later was the head of the DEA under the Reagan administration, and he was quoted as saying that the CIA was bringing cocaine into our country. If the head of the DEA was saying that, you know it's true, and it's just disgusting.
Well, you know, here's a true story. When we went into Afghanistan and threw out the Taliban, the poppy seed production for heroin in Afghanistan was negligible. The Taliban had basically stopped it. And when we went in, the production went through the roof. And I am told that our incredible military, some of the guys were assigned to protect the fields.
George, I just finished reading a book by the guy by the name of Scott Horton, who said it was a fool's errand, and he was writing about Afghanistan. And I was shocked, but I know it's true, that there's so much of the opium poppy in Afghanistan. The DEA went in there to try to eradicate it, and they were finally told not to because it would destabilize the country's economy completely. And a lot of the people in government in Afghanistan are the drug lords there. So actually, he said, and my goodness, maybe it's true, that we had United States Marines that were protecting this guy's opium, opium crop in Afghanistan. Talk about an irony, but it's money, George. It's money, and it isn't working.
And we've been there since 2001, and we still haven't.
America's longest war, and we have to get out of Afghanistan. We shouldn't have been there, and you can come back to the Constitution, because only Congress can declare war. They have abrogated their responsibility in Vietnam and Korea and certainly Afghanistan and Libya and the rest to the president, and we've got to make Congress bring it back. Because if we're going to go to war, we have an absolute obligation to our armed forces to make sure that it's in protection of our national interest and our national security, and that has not been happening in the last 20 years.
Judge, two incredible cases where juries have awarded apparent cancer victims billions of dollars, claiming that Monsanto's Roundup caused cancer. These were juries. They made the decision, and so be it. And Monsanto, you know, other than settlements, gonna have to pay out a lot of money. Are those systems fair?
You know, there are lots of protections in the system. I was on the bench for 25 years as a trial court judge, and I think I only changed about four jury verdicts in that 25 years. And you can't change them. You just simply say, settle it in this way, or I'll give you a new trial. So I have to say that if the jury heard it under our system, I didn't hear the evidence. So I believe in the jury system, mm-hmm. and by and large, I think they get it right. So if that's what they said, with all the protections, you can appeal, you can have the judge maybe order a new trial. So I'm pretty comfortable, without knowing the facts of any case, that if the jury said it and it's within the system, I think that pretty much it's probably correct.
We've got Judge Jim Gray with us. We're going to take calls next hour with the judge. If you will have a question, jump aboard. If you have a story, maybe you've been involved in the judicial system and you want to share one of your stories with us, please do so and do that next hour. Judge, where's it headed? I mean, what do you think's going to happen in the next 10 years with the way our court system is based today?
I think that our court system, George, regretfully is becoming more and more political. I fault numbers of things with the United States Supreme Court. You go back to the case of Michigan versus White 15 years ago, where they said people can run for office and and they can run under a political party's banner. We should keep it non-political in the judiciary. And now, of course, we have so much money involved and the rest. I fear that we are becoming more political in our judicial system. It's critically important that judges are not only independent, but they're seen as being independent, because judges have two requirements, two mandates. One is to do justice as well as we can under the facts and the law and the ethics of our profession, extremely important. But the second is for anyone concerned to believe they're receiving justice. And I think we're falling down as to that. I think people are feeling that our institutions are failing us, which is a cancer upon our society. We've got to keep the independence of the judiciary not only present and actual, but seen as being present and actual. And we're falling away from it. I'm concerned.
Are you saying it's getting worse than better?
Yes, it's getting worse. Everything in our country seems to be more polarized. You see the United States Supreme Court, where there's a certain number of so-called conservative justices, so-called liberal justices, and they're voting in that direction. And I'm fearful that our institutional judicial system is seen as becoming more political, which is not a good thing.
Our special judge, Judge Jim Gray, with us. His website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. He's also got a couple books out there, War on Drugs and Wearing the Robe. The War on Drugs, gosh, I don't know. I think you're right. I think I'm right. I don't know why they don't do it. It's a simple solution.
George, this situation is now being overcome by the taxpayers, so the people, it's just amazing. You get back to Bill Clinton, who said, oh, you know, I'd smoked marijuana but didn't inhale, a national joke. You have George W. Bush, who basically acknowledged using cocaine when he was a playboy, et cetera. Obama, I read his book before he ran for president, and he acknowledged that he used marijuana pretty much regularly. Once they then get into Washington, for some reason they just lose their whole sense of reality. And things keep getting worse with all of those judges. Even President Trump, when he was running, said, oh, the war on drugs isn't working. He's been there for 2 years now. Have you seen any change at all?
Nope.
Attorney General Sessions was doubling down on what's been proven not to work. We need to stand up and demand that drug prohibition be repealed. It is the biggest failed policy in the history of our country, second only to slavery. Pretty solid condemnation, and I'll stand by it, George.
And wouldn't petty crime drop because, you know, some of these thugs don't have to rob somebody for drug money?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, you know, Switzerland came out with a program where if you were addicted to heroin, you could go into a maintenance system where you could actually be prescribed heroin by a medical doctor. Shoplifting went down eightfold or in the neighborhood surrounding the clinics, the check offenses, all the rest of this stuff. The answer is yes. If you want to reduce crime, repeal drug prohibition and hold people accountable for their actions, but bring them closer to medical professionals that can help them instead of labeling them criminals and pushing them farther away. It's just self-evident. And I've seen it as a federal prosecutor and as a judge. It's just time to get this out there and tell the people in Washington, Sacramento, or wherever it isn't working. Have the courage to stand up, because now the votes are there. It's just a short question of time.
Would you go into law again if you had to do all over again?
Oh, yes. It really, I felt that it was so gratifying as a judge to be able to try to do the right thing for the right reason. And you're able to set up programs. I was within 6 months of 1983, when I was appointed to the municipal court in Orange County, put in the first drug court in the country. And I have a stack of letters that I'm really proud of. You take people off alcohol, and I had a letter, for example, Dear Judge Gray, I was going to divorce my husband. He'd get drunk. He'd beat me up. He'd be irresponsible with the children. But now that he's off alcohol, you've given me my husband back. You know, how many letters like that do you need to know that you're on the right track? Because we can, the purpose of the criminal justice system is not to punish, it's to reduce crime.
It's to reduce crime.
What you need to do is address the basic reasons why people go into crime, like drug addiction, mental illness, that sort of thing. And we can do that. And by and large, we are doing that a great deal more quite successfully.
Let's take some calls.
And it's working.
We'll take our calls with you next when we come back. Phone calls and questions for Judge Jim Gray. Or if you've been involved in the judicial system, you want to share that story with us, we'll take that too.